As you can probably tell by the title of this episode, today's case is a kidnapping case involving a child. As always, I won't go into graphic details and will only tell you the necessary facts of the case. This is a true story, but names have been disguised so as to protect real identities. Listener discretion is advised. The rain stopped and the sky cleared over Fort Worth, Texas. 35-year-old Jennifer and her 8-year-old daughter headed outside for a walk to take advantage of the weather while they had been cat-sitting for a friend. It was May 18th, 2019. The day seemed whimsical. They were barefoot, searching for acorns and sticks. They wanted to drop leaves into the stream of rainwater and watch them float away like tiny boats. But something interrupted them. A car stopped. A stranger got out. "Do you like money?" the man asked Jennifer. "Well, I think everyone likes money, but I don't need any. Thank you, though," Jennifer said back. The man kept coming towards her. She recognized him almost instantly. He had been driving the silver-looking car that had been following them around twice in the neighborhood while they were on their mother-daughter walk. "As soon as I realized it's the same vehicle from earlier, that was a big red flag for me," Jennifer would later testify in court. She instinctively felt something was wrong. He was going to try to take her daughter. She could sense it. Jennifer tried to shield her only child to protect her. "It's like something snapped. He just came and grabbed her. He came around, like around me and grabbed her. And from there, it became a full-blown, like physical, just a fight for my daughter's life," Jennifer said. The stranger grabbed the little girl and threw her into his car. He drove off so fast that Jennifer couldn't read his license plate, but she did notice a handicapped sign on the car. She was breathless and frantic as she begged a 911 dispatcher to help her. Jennifer's daughter was in second grade. She got almost perfect grades at school. At home, the little girl had a dog and two cats, so she was kind to animals. She liked being with her friends and playing video games with her dad. But there could be a quiet side to her, too. She didn't mind being alone. In fact, she could paint for hours. She was artistic and creative, full of imagination. Her mother, who wasn't with her dad but still had a good co-parenting relationship with him, seemed to foster those interests. Jennifer was the kind of mom who went to Target with a shopping list for ingredients to make slime. "I'm never going to see her again," Jennifer said while on the phone with the 911 dispatcher. Truly a mother's worst nightmare. This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 151. Did you know that inflammation in the body is the cause of so many issues? From anxiety to insomnia to skin issues and hair thinning? Fittish is a wellness brand that offers affordable and transparent CBD options ranging from tinctures that help promote a better sense of overall balance to a wide array of skincare that fits into your lifestyle. Fittish CBD has helped hundreds of thousands of people dealing with issues, from acne to the most severe cases of dry skin, or those who had the desire to just feel better. I started using the Doing It CBD moisturizer on my skin a couple weeks ago, and it's super lightweight, doesn't have any annoying fragrance, and it doesn't feel sticky or gooey. In fact, it makes my skin look more even and fresh, even without makeup. Try Fittish CBD for yourself to get the best wellness in the game at fittish.com and use the code COURT15 for 15% off your order. That's FITISH.com and enter the code COURT15 at checkout for 15% off your order. Fittish, a clear mind and clearer skin for the win. In a federal courtroom 4 months later, in September 2019, Jennifer testified about those heart-racing moments as she fought for her daughter during the random, unprovoked attack that happened early in the evening in a nice part of town. I was grabbing him and grabbing his shirt, grabbing his necklace, trying to grab his face, like anything I could do to try and keep him from getting into the car with my daughter, Jennifer said. The stranger grabbed her little girl and threw her into the passenger seat of his car. She was terrified. Twice, Jennifer tried to get into the car, scrambling to reach her daughter. She fought to get into the driver's seat where the stranger was. She was almost on his lap. He presses the gas and takes off with the car door still open and just starts driving off with us in the vehicle and telling me to get out of the car, you bitch. Get out of the car, Jennifer said. I'm screaming for him to stop and trying to find the brakes to push my foot on the brakes and having thoughts that I should drive the car into another car, and a lot was going on. He takes off with the door open and I'm screaming for him to stop. And he's yelling, and then at one point he finally slams on the brakes and pushes me out of the car a second time. And then just like that, the car was gone. Her daughter was gone. What was left was a gold chain on the ground. Are you familiar with this gold chain? Prosecutor Aisha Salim asked Jennifer. Yes, Jennifer said. How are you familiar with it? I'm the one that ripped the chain off of him, Jennifer said. Jennifer's brain was swirling. She began screaming for help. A stunned neighbor came out and let her use a phone to call 911. She couldn't focus on the details. A Priority One call went out to the Fort Worth Police Department. A Priority One call is the highest priority, according to patrol officer Nolberto Ibarra. According to Officer Ibarra's testimony, quote, a female had called in saying that her child was kidnapped by a black male wearing a navy blue shirt with a gold chain. It had just occurred and they went southbound. Officer Ibarra responded to Fort Worth's Ryan Place neighborhood, a part of town he described to the court as up and coming. A nice neighborhood, he said. Wide, tree-lined streets, homes being renovated, new businesses coming in. Officer Ibarra also knew the area had been a target for break-ins. He wondered if any neighbors had security cameras that had inadvertently captured the kidnapping. One neighbor had a camera on, but doubted there was anything on it. Officer Ibarra wanted to try anyway. And then he got lucky. When the neighbor checked it, he found a recording that was a few seconds long. It showed the end part from the passenger side door all the way to the back bumper of a silver car. Then there was Jennifer coming out of the driver's side of the vehicle, running and screaming for help. The jury saw flashes of the video, slowed down, so they could see the scene Officer Ibarra had just described. The neighbor, barefoot, then walked out to the front of his house to see what the commotion was. The back of a car is visible for a split second before it pulls away quickly. Another police officer was a huge car enthusiast. He looked at the video Officer Ibarra had collected. Hey, the other officer said, that actually looks like a Ford 500. More strokes of luck for the Fort Worth Police Department. Jennifer had randomly snapped a photo of her daughter earlier that day. This picture was taken by the mother for no reason, said Prosecutor Aaron Neely Cox. Just a moment of any day. Just a happy moment in a typical day between a mother and a daughter that was captured. And the mother will also tell you that she could never have anticipated that this would be the picture that she would hours later be handing over to the Fort Worth Police Department so that they could identify her little girl and tell what she was wearing that day. That photo of the little girl went out across the city as police officers knocked on doors and looked for more security videos. News of the kidnapping was buzzing on social media. Police were on call, using a designated channel to communicate only about the case. All hands on deck. A special agent with the Homeland Security Department was in the middle of his birthday dinner with his family when he was interrupted by a text message from his sergeant notifying him about the abduction. The birthday celebration was canceled quickly, and he dropped his family off before heading to the scene. That night and into the early morning hours, the emergency call dispatch was slammed with calls, as people reported tips if they noticed a silver four-door sedan or something else that was suspicious. Fort Worth police officer Dutch Rovell testified, "We responded to a handful, maybe 3 to 5 calls, for service where citizens believed that they had possibly seen the suspect vehicle that the suspect and child were in. They were four-door silver sedans, and so as part of us assisting in stopping those vehicles, we would conduct traffic stops or investigative stops in order to try and identify whoever was in the vehicle and hopefully locate the child." One such tip came a little after midnight. A desk clerk from the WoodSpring Suites called in to say that someone had called her to report that a man who matched the kidnapper's description was with a young girl at the hotel. That man was staying in room 333. When Forest Hills officers arrived, they knocked on the door to room 333 for 7 minutes, before finally, a man began to talk to them through the door. Officers spent another 8 minutes trying to get the man to open up. He finally did. Sergeant Richardson Wolf showed the man a photo of the little girl and said, "I'm looking for her. If you'll just let me in, I don't care about your drugs or guns or whatever else you're doing in there. I just want to find the child." The man reluctantly let him inside, and Sergeant Wolf looked through the room and the bathroom. He didn't see the girl, so the officers left. But 2 hours later, they would be back. Jeffrey King was a church pastor in another town. He had known the 8-year-old girl's father since high school. That evening, Jeffrey got a text from a mutual friend. The little girl had been kidnapped. By then, the news was all over Facebook. "I immediately felt like we should be doing something," Jeffrey said. First, he prayed with his wife. Then he got into his truck and took off to join the volunteer search party. Quote, "I'm a Christian and I believe that that was one of the things that was laid on my heart just to go do. I mean, I didn't like hear the voice from heaven or anything like that, but I just felt very strongly that that's what I should go do. And I have 2 boys myself, and so that's another reason why I felt I needed to go." On paper, Jeffrey might not have been the best volunteer to help. He wasn't familiar with Fort Worth. He had no idea where he was going. He kept getting lost and ending up at the wrong place. But he was fiercely determined. He spent hours searching, anything to help find his friend's daughter. The word went out for people to search parks, apartments, and hotels, a seemingly endless list of places where the kidnapper could be hiding. Jeffrey pulled out his Maps app on his phone and randomly headed out into the city. By 2 a.m., Jeffrey was accompanied by a friend. They had been searching for hours for Ford 500s, the make of the car police had identified earlier from the surveillance camera. And then, there it was, at the WoodSpring Suites, a silver Ford 500. When we pulled into the hotel parking lot, we drove around, saw the Ford 500, got out of the vehicle, looked in the passenger side, and saw blood smeared on the seat, Jeffrey said. The only reason they had stopped at the WoodSpring Suites off the interstate was because they drove past it en route to another hotel. They called 911. Christy Merrill took the call, as she worked the graveyard shift that night for the police department. "Everybody was working trying to find this little girl, so I sent it to everybody. All men could look at it and check on it," she testified. "I sent it as a priority one call because he said something about blood on the seat." "What does priority one call mean?" the prosecutor asked. "It means as soon as I send it, the officers are going to get on it," she said. Sergeant Wolf from the Forest Hills Police Department arrived first, his second time having been called there that night. The hotel was technically in Forest Hills, Texas, just outside the Fort Worth city limits. Sergeant Wolf checked out the car, but didn't believe that it was related to the kidnapping. But soon after, officers from Fort Worth, along with federal law enforcement officials, responded too. They felt differently. Jeffrey stood back and watched. In the early morning hours of May 19th, 2019, it was about to be the site of a police raid. Officer Dutch Rovell was a fast-talking police dispatcher who had recently become a Fort Worth cop about a year earlier. He was one of the first to arrive on the scene. He drove stealthily into the darkness with no lights or sirens alerting his presence. He told the court, "I had made the decision, actually, to deactivate all of the lights, headlights, taillights, in an attempt to hopefully obscure our presence, due to the fact that there are several windows for rooms at the hotel. I didn't want to be immediately obvious that we were at the location for anyone inside." There, just as the police alert had said, was the car. The Ford 500 did indeed have a handicapped license plate, like Jennifer had described. There was blood on the passenger seat cushion. Enough blood that one investigator later testified he worried that cemented the little girl's fate. Underneath the passenger seat was a single child's earring. There was also something else on the driver's side. Small, circular gold links that appeared to come from a necklace. Officer Rovell believed they had the right vehicle. Now they had to get into the hotel. He ran to the front door and immediately ran into a hotel employee. He told her he needed room information. It was urgent. Renting a room in the hotel required showing a driver's license. The hotel employee gave him a photocopy of the man who had rented room 333 and who had checked in more than a week earlier. Officer Rovell got on the radio and informed his partner that the photocopy of the driver's license was that of a bald black male. Other officers entered the hotel at that point, and they made their way to room 333. The atmosphere was hectic as the officers got into place and went to the third floor room. Officer Rovell held a ballistic shield. They knocked and announced their presence. No answer. They tried to use a key card the hotel employee had given them. The door wouldn't open. It appeared to be locked or barricaded, and so the officers made the decision to bring breaching equipment to the door so that they could force their way into the room. The prosecutor asked, "Why?" "We believed in that moment, with the totality of the circumstances to this point, that the victim was in the room and might be in immediate danger," Officer Rovell said.
"Ford Police Department, open the door!"
There were noises coming from inside. "Hey, I'm getting dressed," a voice said.
"Open it now!"
"Break it."
The officers hit the door with a battering ram, once, then twice. And then the door was opened by a man who was completely naked.
"Hands! Let me see your hands! Step out here! Step out!"
John Koshan, the special agent with the Homeland Security investigations who got the call to help during his birthday dinner, described the scene to the jury. "We instructed him to get out, come out of the room. He didn't immediately come out. He kind of resisted. He argued. He was very belligerent in the doorway. At that point, he was removed from the room. He was passed in my direction down the hall. I took custody of him at that point and took him to the ground. Another officer assisted me. When he went to the ground, I had his left arm pinned to the floor, while the other officer was able to get control of him from the rear. However, his right arm was still pinned underneath of him, and he was trying to resist, like push his way up. As they were securing him, he heard another officer yell from inside the room, 'We've got her. We've got her.'"
"We have her."
The call went out over the radio. They had found the little girl, and one person was in custody. The girl was alive. She had visible cuts and bruises on her, but she was alive. Special Agent Koshan testified that she was in a state of shock, and he told her, "You're going to be okay." Officer Rovell didn't want the little girl to spend another moment in the hotel room. Another officer wrapped her up in a blanket and carried her down the stairs. In the moment, Officer Rovell uttered profanity as he escorted them. "I was very emotional and was taken aback that we had actually found her," he said later, explaining his choice of words. He couldn't help it. Right away, Officer Rovell wanted to protect the little girl, to keep her hidden from the rest of the world and to be somewhat safe. He called for his partner, Officer Tiffany Hayes, a female police officer, to stay with her in her patrol car. "What was the child's demeanor like at this point?" the prosecutor asked. "Scared, just quiet," Officer Hayes testified. She said she offered up her cell phone for the little girl to play a game called Subway Surfers in order to distract her. "I just keep talking to her, just trying to take her mind off of what had occurred, just trying to get her to relax a little bit and to understand that she was safe." Meanwhile, Officer Rovell paced. He was still trying to control his emotions. Within minutes, the ambulance arrived. Officer Hayes rode with the little girl. The rest of the officers took action. "We made sure that we put our patrol cars very far out in front of that ambulance the entire ride to the hospital, running our lights and sirens to make sure there was nothing stopping us from getting her to the hospital," Officer Rovell said. Once they reached the children's hospital, before the girl could be reunited with her parents, Officer Hayes remained by her side. "I'm not leaving her at this point, so everywhere she went, I went. I stayed by her bedside in her room and just continued to talk to her." Officer Hayes asked what the girl's favorite movie was and other getting-to-know-you questions. She noticed she only wore one earring. Soon, the little girl's parents arrived. Jennifer testified that the moment she saw her daughter, she gave her a kiss and told her how much she loves her and how proud she was of her. She said her daughter smiled at her, but looked like she was somewhere else. Officer Hayes watched the parents embrace and hug the girl. She relaxed, but she still sensed the little girl's fear. The girl was in a wheelchair and covered in blankets. She said she couldn't say what had happened because she was told that her parents would be killed if she did. The nurse reassured her that she was safe now. Jennifer testified that she was present at her daughter's medical exam. She was still being extremely brave and pretending kind of almost as if nothing had happened, or was trying to put on this tough front for us and for everyone, Jennifer said. "And at some point, did you see that her being brave is not what's really how she's feeling?" the prosecutor asked. "Yes," Jennifer said. The defense objected to this line of questioning. "Calls for speculation, Your Honor." "Sustained. I think we can move on from this subject," said the judge. The prosecutor agreed. Coloring your hair in the comfort of your own home is something a lot of people are doing nowadays. But you might be wondering how you would find the right color, and then what about the cost? Well, Madison Reed makes coloring your hair at home affordable, and they give you the tools you need to choose your perfect color. Madison Reed takes coloring your hair at home to the next level and gives you beautiful, professional hair color delivered right to your door, starting at just $22. For decades, there were only two options for coloring your hair. You could either try outdated at-home color or spend time and money at a salon, but not anymore. Madison Reed's color is unique. It's crafted by master colorists who blend nuances of light, dark, cool, and warm tones to create over 55 gorgeous multidimensional shades. And finding the perfect shade is a lot easier than you think. You just go to their website, madison-reed.com, and take their quick online quiz that will ask you all sorts of questions about your hair. Then they match you with your perfect shade. So do your hair coloring at home and look as if you just came from the salon. Now, Court Junkies can get 10% off plus free shipping on their first color kit by using the code COURT. Go to madison-reed.com and use the code COURT. That's madison-reed.com and use the code COURT. Do not sleep on the Jordan Harbinger Show. It's a podcast you really should be listening to, and I'm not kidding when I say that court junkies will especially love it. Jordan's show, which Apple named one of its best of 2018, is aimed at making you a better informed, more critical thinker, so you can get a sense of how the world actually works and come to your own conclusions about what's happening, even inside your own brain. Each episode is a conversation with a different fascinating guest, and there is something for everyone here. In one episode, Jordan talks to a hostage negotiator from the FBI, who offers techniques on how to get people to like and trust you. Another episode tells the story of a cinematographer who discovered a lost city in the jungle and made one of the most important archaeological finds of the century. One of his more recent episodes was with Bruce Sackman, a renowned investigator who tracks down serial killers. Another was with Thomas Erickson, a behavioral expert who talks about how to identify psychopaths. I really enjoyed this show, and I think you will as well. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R-B as in boy, I-N as in Nancy, G-E-R, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. A man I'm going to refer to as Michael Smith had been staying in room 333 and was taken into custody. With the hotel manager's help, Special Agent Koshan looked at the surveillance video to find evidence for their investigation. He was looking to see what time Michael and the little girl arrived on site, or if any other suspects had helped Michael as an accomplice. Motion sensors activated the cameras, which then started recording. The motel had 15 cameras on property, including one posted right outside room 333. The hotel manager, who spent 4 hours with police looking at the video, was horrified by what she saw. The footage showed Michael Smith dressed in a running suit and wearing his gold chain, not yet broken, as he left his hotel room on May 18, 2019 at 5:17 p.m., the last time before the kidnapping. Another key moment was captured at 8:41 p.m. when Michael and the little girl returned. It also showed something else. "And who is in this video exactly?" the prosecutor asked. "It's the defendant, Michael Smith, along with the juvenile victim, and then in the room, an unidentified female," Agent Koshan said. The woman left the hotel room 10 minutes after Michael and the girl arrived. "All right," said the prosecutor. "And was this the first time that you learned there was a female in the room?" "Yes," Agent Koshan said. "Did you take steps to identify who this female was?" the prosecutor asked. "I immediately notified Detective Heiss and Sergeant Phillips that there was a female who was inside the room. They have attempted to identify her. To my knowledge, she has not yet been identified. She leaves the room about 10 minutes later and doesn't return," he testified. At 2:17 a.m., the same camera captured the police raid and Michael Smith's arrest. The video footage Agent Koshan analyzed was played during Michael's trial as evidence. Authorities searched the hotel room and re-examined the car, finding more items that showed, prosecutors said, that Michael planned out his attack in advance. In the car's console were blue latex gloves. Also found were baby oil and graphic notes. Chris Thompson, a 16-year veteran on the FBI, was a special agent assigned to the Dallas Division who served on the Violent Crimes Against Children Task Force and worked cyber high-tech investigations. He testified that he met Michael Smith in the parking area of the Major Case Unity facility. He brought him a gown to wear so he wouldn't be exposed. Michael was handcuffed, so Agent Thompson dressed him. Right away, Agent Thompson noticed his odd behavior. "His demeanor, he's a little bit slow, and I even asked one of the patrol officers there. I said, 'Is he asleep?' And the patrol officer said, no, he was just looking at me a minute ago. So he got out of the car and was able to respond to all of their commands. We got him dressed just fine and walked him into the building. Michael was taken into a windowless interview room that was sparsely furnished. Three chairs, some tables, two cameras pointed in the room. Agent Thompson was joined by a Fort Worth police detective. They took Michael's handcuffs off for the interview, although shackles were still on his ankles, so he couldn't run away. The interview began. First, the easy questions. What was his full name? Michael quoted his full driver's license number from memory. He was 51 years old, currently homeless, and living in the hotel. The officers read his Miranda rights to him. At times, Michael rested his head on the table. He spoke in a calm voice. Occasionally, he got emotional.
Are you willing to talk to us? Is that a yes? Can you just say yes or no out loud? One, two, sorry. Don't mean
talk
to
you talk
to your mouth. Is it a yes or a no, Michael?
I'll talk to you.
Okay.
Okay. You can keep eating. That's fine.
All right. It's a little warm in here, and I apologize. They do not give me control of the thermostat at all. It's not? I'm burning up in here, so good.
So if you get cold or something, let us know. We can get you a blanket, okay?
Okay. So, Michael, do you know why you're here? Mm-hmm. Can you tell me?
I love a girl.
You said what?
Another girl.
A little girl? Is that what I heard you say? Mm-hmm. Okay.
What little girl like her?
I don't know.
You don't know her?
Michael was willing to keep talking. The interview lasted a total of 3.5 hours. Why did it take 3.5 hours? Why so long? The prosecutor asked. Special Agent Thompson replied, frankly, because Mr. Smith lied through a great portion of the interview. His story shifted numerous times. At no point did he ever state that he was not the person who kidnapped the child, but the reasoning for why he did it shifted several times. He said Michael told them that he had made a, quote, stupid-ass decision, that someone by the name of Nick, no last name identified, had actually paid him $1,000 or planned to pay him $1,000 to, quote, kidnap that bitch daughter. Agent Thompson testified that the Nick story sounded outrageous and unbelievable. We circled back to the Nick story for a period of time because there were very few details provided after that. Mr. Smith stated there was essentially no plan to recontact Nick after he allegedly accomplished his task. There was no photographic evidence taken. There was no way to provide proof. In fact, Mr. Smith made no attempt to reach out to Nick whatsoever. Assistant U.S. Attorney Aisha Saleem asked, and this time, Special Agent Thompson, so Mr. Smith was still maintaining this story of this drug dealer was going to pay me to steal this or abduct this child? Yes, Agent Thompson replied. Was he saying that this was all basically a drug deal? This as a result of a drug deal or something related to Nick? She asked. He made statements such as that, yes. In some moments, Michael gave statements that investigators believed fit better with reality. He described scouting out the neighborhood.
Yeah, listen.
Okay.
I passed by them.
Okay.
But maybe once or twice. No, I passed by them once because that's what I was doing. I was seeing who was outside, who could see this.
Okay, so you were getting the lay of the land before you went in.
Yes.
Okay, so about how long were you doing that?
I cut a few blocks.
That's smart.
It was people out. Yeah, I told you I've been in the streets for a while.
So about how long did you do that?
I don't know. know about how long, but...
Minutes? Hours?
It wasn't no hours, but it was some minutes. I scoped it out pretty good, and I know I missed somebody because when I pushed the woman and grabbed her, I heard somebody screaming.
Uh-huh.
I heard somebody screaming.
Okay. That wasn't her?
No, okay. It was somebody on a porch or something somewhere.
Okay.
I heard that.
Then he talked about the actual kidnapping.
And I asked her, did you need a ride? That's how I initiated the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And I maneuvered myself around and I pushed her.
Mm-hmm.
And I grabbed the girl. And she tried to stop me.
Mm-hmm.
The mom did?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But I pushed her down.
How did she try to stop you? What happened?
She tried to jump in the car.
Okay.
So you pushed her down, and then what happened?
I drove her.
What was the little girl doing during that time?
She was trying to get away.
She was trying to get away?
A little bit. I think she was more shocked.
Uh-huh.
Once he knew he was going to get caught, he said he tried to scare her into not talking to the police.
I told her the cops are going to question you.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, I tried to, I was scolding her, so the cops are going to question you.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll tell you that I'll be in jail and I can't hurt you.
What she said?
So what? Tell them. And she was just quiet. And so, you know, she's 8 and I'm trying to scare her.
Yeah. That
makes sense. You know, I'm just telling you the truth.
Okay.
I'm just telling you the truth.
What did you say? What did you say to scare her, Michael?
I told her that if she said anything, then I would do something to my parents. And if I was in jail, I would have my friends to do it.
Okay.
And she promised not to tell. But she don't have to because I'm a tell.
He was asked if she ever cried when she was with him, and he said no, not once. Michael said he had hidden the little girl in plain sight in a laundry basket in the hotel room when police arrived. The investigators listened straight-faced as Michael talked. They didn't react in horror. They offered snacks and water during the interview. They calmly asked questions to confirm the timeline of events or to pin down specifics. Agent Thompson told the court, "It's a good police interview technique to use practices such as empathy for criminal activity, personality mirroring, things like that to build an association with the person that you're speaking with in order to better elicit information." But Agent Thompson made sure to emphasize, in no way did we actually feel empathy for this person. The trial began in late September 2019. Because Michael had used his phone, a car, hotel, and interstate highways while committing the kidnapping, he was facing trial in federal court. Michael pleaded not guilty to kidnapping. If convicted, the punishment ranged from 20 years in prison up to life in prison. U.S. Attorney Aaron Neely Cox called it a simple case. "Just one count," she told the jury as opening statements began in the trial, "the charge of kidnapping." But while the facts of the case are simple, the evidence will be heartbreaking. The evidence that you will hear, as you've heard this morning, it may be hard for you to hear. It may be emotional for some of the witnesses that you will hear from. But once you see the evidence, your job will be easy, because we will do our job, which is to prove to you that Michael Smith is guilty of kidnapping. He wanted to use his power, not on someone his own size, but on a little girl and a mother who was not a match for him. And in the blink of an eye, everything for this girl and her family changed. Law enforcement officials, 911 call takers, medical personnel, hotel employees, the child's mother, Jennifer, and Jeffrey King, who discovered the car in the hotel parking lot, all testified during the trial. Michael himself did not testify. In fact, he was missing from the courtroom. He had waived his right to be present during the proceedings when the judge asked him if he wanted to change out of his inmate jumpsuit into other clothes. "Actually, I don't even want to be in here," Michael said. "Okay, let me stop you," Judge Reed O'Connor had replied. "You have the right to not be in here, okay? If you want to voluntarily absent yourself from the trial and have the trial proceed without you here, you have that right. Is that what you're asking for?" Michael said yes, even though his own attorney and the prosecutors preferred for him to stay in the courtroom. "Do you understand that by not being in here to do that, that could work to your detriment? You understand that?" the judge asked Michael. "In other words, you're not here to help them. And if you know something that they don't know, or if there is some sort of nuanced fact about the issue, you're not here to tell them. That could be to your detriment." Michael said he understood. It made for some strange moments in court transcripts when the prosecutors, the defense, and the judge discussed how a witness could identify the defendant in open court if Michael wasn't in the room. At one point, the judge said the witness could walk back and look at the guy in the cell and then come back and ID him in court. Michael's defense team didn't cross-examine any witnesses and didn't call anyone to the stand. Before both sides presented their closing arguments, the judge gave the jury their instructions. The indictment charged Michael Smith with committing the offense of kidnapping and that he knowingly, acting contrary to law, seized, kidnapped, confined, abducted, carried away, or held. The indictment also said that the defendant used any means, facility, or instrumentality of interstate or foreign commerce in committing or in furtherance of the commission of the offense. The federal kidnapping statute requires that the prosecution must prove that Michael participated in interstate commerce during the crime. In her closing arguments, U.S. Assistant Attorney Aisha Saleem told the jury, "We are proving that there was an interstate commerce nexus. There's no magic to this. The fact that the defendant used a hotel, not only to commit the crime, but that also to conceal the child. You've heard testimony that this is a hotel that is actually set up by the highway, Interstate 20. So this is really nothing new or novel. He used the hotel. The hotel is a means of facility under interstate commerce. We also established that he used his cell phone. How do we know that? Well, not only did Mr. Smith say he used his cell phone in order to get back to the hotel and the commission of the offense, we also discovered that cell phone on top of the car. He took Highway 35 and Highway 20 to get back to the hotel. These are facilities that go through interstate commerce because each are highways that move across state lines. That means that he traveled to get back to the hotel. So I submit to you, we have more than adequately proved beyond a reasonable doubt that he used a means, a facility of interstate commerce. She asked the jury to find Michael guilty. When it was his turn, federal public defender John Stickney didn't downplay the graphic evidence the jury heard during trial. "The evidence presented in this case is at times gruesome," he said. But he attacked the prosecutor's handling of the case. He said they spent the majority of their case appealing to the jury's emotions. But he urged them to look at the fact that Michael was accused of kidnapping, a federal offense, and that the government failed to present sufficient evidence about interstate commerce. He said the government failed to explain it and that they are simply overreaching. In the end, the jury sided with the prosecution. After just 10 minutes of deliberation, Michael Smith was found guilty of kidnapping. U.S. Attorney Aaron Neely Cox asked a judge for the maximum punishment during Michael's sentencing on November 14th, 2019. It was more than just a kidnapping, she said in her remarks at the hearing. The defendant in this case stole the child's innocence. He took from her her ability to feel safe in her community, and he took from her as a child her ability to think that the fight between good and evil is just the stuff of fairy tales and bedtime stories. She knows now that is not true. He took that from her. She knows that there is an evil in this world. She has a memory of it. She has nightmares of it. Evil has a face, and that face is Mr. Smith. The judge ordered Michael Smith to spend the rest of his life in prison. Michael has also been indicted on additional charges in state court related to the kidnapping. That case is still pending as of this recording. And that's all for this episode. As always, I'd love to know your thoughts on this case. Let me know on Instagram at CourtJunkie by tweeting me at CourtJunkiePod or by emailing me at podcast@CourtJunkie.com. But I'd like to ask that when discussing this on public forums, please do not give away any real identities. This case had a better outcome than most of the kidnapping cases we've heard about, but there is no doubt incredible, lasting damage that was caused. And I'd like for this family to be able to move on the best they can without their names being made public. This episode was researched and written by Gabrielle Roussan. If you'd like to hear these episodes without the ads and hear additional Court Junkie bonus episodes, check out my Patreon options at courtjunkie.com/support. And be sure to subscribe to my YouTube channel at youtube.com/courtjunkie. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.